CRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, In 2022, Let's Tax the Rich. 10 billionaires added $402 billion to their fortunes in 2021. Stay tuned for more. The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. Heading into 2022, the 10 wealthiest individuals in the world are all worth more than $100 billion, CNBC noted, citing the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, which tracks and ranks the fortunes of the planet's richest people. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said recently that the staggering growth of billionaire wealth amid the worldwide public health emergency and economic crisis should compel Congress to finally redress the fundamental injustices of the U.S. tax system. Jayapal said, in 2022, let's tax the rich and invest in our communities. At the top of the billionaires index at the close of 2021 was Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk, who added over $121 billion to his wealth last year as the pandemic both took and completely upended lives, pushing tens of millions of people into poverty and intensifying pre-existing inequities. Just behind Musk on the list was former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who tacked $5 billion onto his net worth in 2021, leaving him with a total fortune of $195 billion. In November, the head of the World Food Program, WFP, outlined a proposal by which Musk, now the richest man in the world, and other U.S. billionaires could donate just 0.36% of their pandemic wealth gains to help 42 million people facing starvation. The $6.6 billion required would help those in most need in the following way. One meal a day, the basic needed to survive, costing 43 dollars per person per day. Averaged out across the 43 countries, the WFP said this would feed 42 million people for 1 year and avert the risk of famine. The billionaires have not taken the WFP up on its modest plan to save millions of lives with a fraction of their pandemic profits. The investigative outlet ProPublica reported in June that Musk, along with other U.S. billionaires, paid $0 in federal income taxes in 2018. Late last year, Musk garnered widespread publicity for selling off a portion of his Tesla stock, triggering a significant taxable event. But as Bob Lord, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, observed in a recent blog post, Musk has paid tax in 2021, lots of it because doing so was by far his best option. Did he pay more tax than any American in history, as he claims? Probably Lord wrote, but he also received compensation of more than $20 billion, which almost certainly dwarfs the compensation any other CEO in American history has ever been paid from a company with profits not remotely commensurate with that level of compensation. The updated billionaire wealth figures come as Democrats in Congress are struggling to chart a path forward for their flagship social spending and climate legislation, which has been held up by corporate-backed Senator Joe Manchin. The House-passed version of the Build Back Better Act includes a surtax on millionaires and other measures to help fund the bill's investments and reduce out-of-control inequality. According to the Washington Post, Manchin recently told the Biden White House that he would be willing to support some version of a tax targeting billionaires, an idea that the West Virginia Democrat criticized in October. While the specifics of what Manchin would support remain unclear, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden has unveiled a tax aimed at the accrued wealth of America's approximately 700 billionaires, the Post noted. The measure is aimed at addressing the massive gains of the wealthiest Americans with a federal tax and probably would be unprecedented in how few people it affected. Congress nonpartisan scorekeeper has estimated it would raise as much as $550 billion over 10 years, or pay for more than one quarter of the Democrats' spending bill. In a social media post on New Year's Day, the Patriotic Millionaires, a group composed of wealthy supporters of progressive taxation, warned that history paints a bleak picture of what happens to extremely unequal societies. For the well-being of rich and poor alike, it's time to confront inequality and choose to tax the rich, the group wrote. If you don't, then all the talk at Davos won't change what's coming. It's taxes or pitchforks.
The Shaheed.
Part 6.
Within 2 months of the martyrdom of Haj Qasim, I was invited to an anti-US conference in Caracas, Venezuela. When I opened the posters and banners of Haj Qasim, I was flabbergasted by the response of the people there. Almost everybody had at least heard his name. Soon, all the sessions of the conference were adorned with the pictures of the Shaheed. On the last day of our visit, a solidarity gathering was held for the people of Iran to condole the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani in one of the main squares of Caracas. At the end of the ceremony, a native Venezuelan woman started performing a sad song, and I only understood one word from her song: Soleimani. I'm Sarbazul Rizvi, and in this episode of The Shaheed, we will examine the resonance of efforts made by Shaheed Soleimani miles apart in Latin America. Stay tuned.
Hello.
Venezuelan Palestinian writer and analyst, Susanna Khalil. Susanna Khalil, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Recently, President Maduro had an interview with Al Mayadeen where he said about the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. He said, is this really a world we want, where the White House issues an order to kill a hero of the struggle against terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon? So some may ask, Susanna Khalil, some may ask that how the martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani, a man who was involved in the issues of West Asia, is being, you know, echoed or, you know, reflected in South America and Latin American region, which is thousands of miles away.
Yes, but before to answer that, I would like to say that the USA assassination of the General Qasem Soleimani and the Commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandi was because these two men together succeed or advance in combating the nefarious terrorism. To give you one example, in Syria. And the assassination of Soleimani is a victory for pseudo or fake Islamic terrorists coordinated by the West and Gulf tyrannies such as Saudi Arabia and the other Arab regimes and the Turkish government. I would like to mention that the Western world find it hard to believe that the fascist, the fake Islamic group are largely the creation of the West, where the first victim are Muslim, and the first who fight them are Muslim themselves. And I will be brief today. The big fighter in the world of Islamic fascism, the false Islam, are Iran, Hezbollah, Russia, and Syria. No doubt about that. General Soleimani, he believes in local popular groups to fight the terrorism. I mean the people, the same people who yes. are in coordination to how to fight the terrorism. And I would also to talk concerning Latin America, the effect of the consequences in Latin America. It's definitely we as a Latin American, we feel that it's not something bizarre. It's not something far from Latin America. We know that this is a crime made. Even we see it as a logic, but which logic? Of imperialism logic, of a fascist logic. Is in Latin America. The people see this assassination like a crime, but which is normal in this imperialistic reality. We are in the 21st century, and we are still talking about imperialism, colonialism, and this is the real fascism, the main fascism of our time. So Latin America, concerning the martyr, Soleimani martyr, this is for in Latin America is the same like in the Arab world, on the Persian world, Persian world. They say he was a victim of freedom. He was victim of terrorism. He is victim because he is fighting for sovereignty. He is fighting for freedom. He is fighting for this fascist order, international order, which is the case.
Now let me ask one question. You talked about Latin America and how the martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani is connected to the people in Latin America, and also I know that you have a Palestinian background as well, and Palestine is a victim of neoliberalism. Actually, the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause is actually as a result of the neoliberalism. So, how do you find the contribution of General Qasem Soleimani to particularly the Palestinian cause?
Okay, in Latin America, the assassination and the even the trajectory of Soleimani is an inspiration. this is a human being that is a human of respect, loyalty, and he is a martyr of this fascist international system. And I'm talking about Latin America. And as a Palestinian, we have a huge respect for this determination, this brave determination of this man who is fighting against imperialism. I insist with the term imperialism because many people want to talk about freedom, justice, human rights, democracy, but they avoid the reality of imperialism. This is a big hypocrisy when we talk about even women's rights and we don't talk about the reality of imperialism. The biggest violation of human rights is come from the reality of this retrograde reality of imperialism, and the position of the Iran concerning Palestine, because how come we are in the 21st century and that we are still supporting colonialism? Israel is a classic colonialism. This regime is a colonial regime. As a classic colonialism, and we cannot accept it in our time, in our history, in our mind, in our spirit, in our freedom, in our awareness of justice. Mm-hmm. As a Palestinian, we have to continue and to support this kind of position, brave position, honest position against imperialism, against the colonialism. This is anachronism today in the 21st century. At the same time, Iran is paying a huge price for have this moral, ethical, and honest position for justice. Because yes. The Palestinian people are fighting. There's a native people who are fighting a colonizer, Europe colonization.
Exactly.
And Iran is the, I can't say Iran and Syria is the main supporter now for Palestinian cause, for Palestinian liberation, liberation from colonialism, which yes. is a retrograde reality in our time.
Yes.
How come we are in the 21st century and that we are still talking about colonialism?
Yes.
No way. We have it's impossible to erase and to hide the colonial reality, which is the natural of the state of Israel.
Okay, I will continue my talk with Susanna Khalil after the reflection of this criminal assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis by Americans in the Latin American context.
The General Soleimani assassination in Latin America and the Spanish language press had a flavor of its own, as was the case with any other region of the world. Also, the spices grew sharper or milder from one Latino country to another. But what you may find funny, angering, and bewildering all at once is the tone the American press and Zionist lobby took towards Soleimani's martyrdom in relation to Latin America. They wasted no time in drawing on old cases to turn the media tide against Iran. The Wall Street Journal actually said that Latin America should be thanking Trump for assassinating Soleimani. The article focuses more than anything on the AMIA bombing in Argentina and the death of the AMIA case prosecutor that followed, the prosecutor being Alberto Nisman. The article paints such a dark picture of the suicide van bomb attack on the Argentine-Israeli Mutual Association, or AMIA building, in Buenos Aires, Argentina in 1994, that it diminishes the gravity of the Soleimani assassination. It even justifies it. Even what good relations Iran and Latin American countries share, the article undermines as solely security and military-based. It paints the governments of Cuba, Venezuela, and Bolivia as oppressive governments that would, of course, receive backing from the likes of Iran. But actually, no one could have dealt the region a greater socio-political blow than the U.S. with its numerous sanctions and coup d'etats imposed on Latin American countries. One of the most important articles on the matter was by the Protect United States Democracies Foundation. The article was published for the anniversary of the assassination and dedicated a good portion to cultural centers' activities in Brazil. One center being the Al-Mustafa University, which had recently been put on America's blacklist of the sanctioned. And so, just its name coming up implied shady activity and sabotage. Now, Argentine's Infobae news agency is connected to the Zionist lobby and is big on following up on the Amia case. And so it published all dark matter coming from American and Zionist lobby press within a framework of its own to create a new wave of support for the U.S. act of state terrorism. It even criticized Venezuela and Cuba for their expression of sympathy right after the general was murdered. Words matter, and a supposedly moderate Spanish tone on both sides of the pond adopted words like matar to water down the assassination by calling it a kill. BBC Spanish was one to do so. Now, politicians in power, the press, and people don't always have the same attitude to a kill or assassination. But only one Latin American leader expressed satisfaction at the assassination of General Soleimani. That was Jair Bolsonaro, the Brazilian president who came to power thanks to a coalition of far-right Brazilian parties. Of course, former President Lula da Silva quickly condemned Bolsonaro as a lackey of Trump. The most positive Latin response came from Venezuela. Each of its dignitaries reacted to the American act of assassination right in the early days following the act. Nicolas Maduro, the then president's government, condemned the assassination as news of it broke out. His foreign minister Jorge Arreaza and other dignitaries visited the Iranian embassy to sign the martyred General Soleimani memorial. One of them, the then National Constituent Assembly chief, at a ceremony with representatives from different countries, called for a standing ovation for the martyred Iranian general. Come the anniversary of the assassination, in the capital Caracas and Venezuela at large, different ceremonies were held for a week with the people participating. And Nicolas Maduro recalled the many assassinations by America. Some other countries sympathizing with Iran and condemning America were Ecuador, whose then President Correa declared that America had committed an act of terror by murdering General Soleimani. Bolivia's then President Evo Morales tweeted that the fight against imperialism had its heroes and martyrs, such as Commander Qasem Soleimani, and that people recognized their fight for justice. The Nicaraguan government and Cuban Foreign Minister Rodriguez also condemned the assassination of Soleimani. Nicaragua invited the world to peace at the same time. In Peru, Muslim and Christian activists gathered in the capital Lima. Demonstrators chanted, "No to imperialist wars, Yankee, go home." As for a most important cultural measure taken in Latin America, that will be the publishing of the book My Uncle Soleimani by El Faro International Publishing House. It was printed in Colombia, Venezuela, and Ecuador for teenagers everywhere in Latin America. Written in simple language, it turned out popular and came to a third printing in some areas.
I'm hosting Susana Khalil, a Palestinian Venezuelan writer and analyst. Susana Khalil, one of the main issues currently we are facing in the West Asian region is the issue of normalization of the ties of some Arab and Muslim countries with Zionist regime. Some of the regimes of the region are normalizing their ties with the Zionist regime. What's your stand on that, and how do you analyze that?
The normalization of the Arab tyranny is not the normalization. This is a betray to the Palestinian cause, and also this is a risk that they are taking even for them in the future for their own sovereignty, because this colonialism is not limited to only to Palestine. The Zionist movement, they say, is not only Palestine to belong to them. They say that even the old Arab world belongs to them. So this is because we are this is a betray, but the betray against the Palestinian cause, and that this is a normalization with colonialism, with fascism, normalization with imperialism, normalization with the right wing. This is a normalization with the violence against the human rights. This is the normalization with the crime. This is normalization with an unfair injustice, and this is normalization against humanity. and this is a betray. Not only with the Palestinian cause, it's a betray to Persian, to Iranian, to all the whole humanity, to all hope even. This is a normalization with fascism. And I think even it's going to be a risk, I insist with that, for themselves, for the sovereignty of their own country. Because colonialism is expansionist. They say that it's not only exactly. Palestine who belongs to them, it's
but the whole region.
The Middle East also. So this is a risk. To make a normalization with them is like you're going to be the next to be part of this colonial expansionist
exactly.
Regime. And this is a very sad situation, which is not new, but we are in the historic moment that we have several allies. For example, we can see the support from Syria, from Persia, from Iran, even the situation of a multipolar international order like China, Russia, even Latin America, the left-wing progressist movement that they have awareness about people, culture, and justice and freedom. So I think they're gonna collapse. But
yeah.
Definitely, we don't have to mix people with the policy of their government
exactly.
or the
of course.
Tyranny.
Exactly.
No, I know that, for example, the case of Morocco, the people of Morocco, they are clear that they support the Palestinian cause,
yeah.
Palestinian liberation,
yeah.
and that we doesn't mean it's they support their own tyrant, the king
yeah.
of Morocco, which is allied to the Zionism, to Zionists and the imperialists. That's why he is there in this power, and we have to continue to struggle, and we can see, for example, the example of. General Soleimani and the commander Abu Mahdi, all together with determination, with the brave character, spirit, mind. This is a school that we have to take it, and
Indeed.
This is a great
Indeed.
Example of dignity that we have. And Soleimani is a symbol, is an inspiration, is a determination, is a clear example of a struggle against imperialism, against the colonialism. I say in colonialism, a classic colonialism that Palestinian native are facing in our time. We are talking about 21st century.
Exactly.
And this is anachronism that
exactly.
we are
Thank
fighting.
You.
And this fight, it doesn't belong only to Palestinians, it belongs to the whole world. And we said that the Palestinians have to be liberated. All Palestine, the historic
Let's
Palestine.
Hope for that.
We have
Let's
a day with history, and we have a depth with humanity. The liberation of Palestine is the liberation of the world. That's why when tyranny and the Emirati, for example, they talk about normalization with the colonial regime of Israel. This is a normalization with fascism, this is normalization with colonialism. This is a normalization
exactly.
with the imperialism. This is a normalization against humanity.
Thank you, Susanna, for being with us, and thank you for accepting our invitation. Thank you.
Thanks to you.
Yes, this was my interview with Susanna Khalil, the Venezuelan-Palestinian writer and analyst. Let's shift to the next part of our program, The Shaheed, which is about the devotion of General Qasem Soleimani to Imam Khomeini as the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and his successor, Imam Khomeini. Stay with us.
By the Soleimani school of thought, we mean a branch of the Imam's thinking. Because General Soleimani's outlook was based on that of the founder of the Islamic Revolution. That is why the present leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, in January 2020, said in his condolence message on the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani, "He is a prominent example of the students of Islam and the Imam Khomeini school." He himself writes in his will, as someone influenced by the late Imam since adolescence, "The art of Dia Khomeini was that he first brought Islam to back up Iran and then set Iran on a path of serving Islam. Had it not been for Islam and the Islamic spirit of this nation, Saddam would have ripped this country apart like a wild wolf. America would have done the same like a rabid dog. But the Imam artfully brought Islam to the nation's rescue, together with Ashura and Muharram, Safar and Fatimiyya mourning days. He created revolutions within a revolution. That is why in every period, thousands have been willing to sacrifice their lives to shield you and the nation and Iran and Islam, and have brought the greatest materialist powers to their knees. Qasem Soleimani, under the influence of Imam Khomeini, fell in the path of revolutionary protest in teenagehood. And after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he joined the IRGC force, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. To his last breath, he put in every effort to help the ideas of the two successive leaders of the revolution materialize. He saw Ayatollah Khamenei as the most similar case to Imam Khomeini, finding no one with such resemblance within clerics anywhere in the world of Islam. He even recommended him in his will. "This scholar, Dia Khamenei, knowledgeable and humble in religion, fiqh or Islamic jurisprudence, and mysticism, hold close to your hearts." He feared if the enemy destroys the Islamic revolution, nothing will be left of Islam, and society will be dragged to full atheism. And so he wrote to religious scholars, "Your soldier has seen from the watchtower that if the system sees harm, the religion and values you have striven for in religious schools will disappear. This era is different from any other era. This time, if they get a hold of affairs, nothing will be left of Islam. The right way is to defend the revolution, the Islamic Republic, and the leader with no considerations."
The slogan and the demand of the people from Afghanistan to Iraq and from Iraq to Latin America has been the same and very simple. Yankee, go home. Thank you for being with this episode of The Shaheed. Stay tuned. Wassalam.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka visited at least twice on 6th of January 2021 in an effort to stop the attack on the U.S. Capitol, according to Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist David Edwards and has been taken from the alternet.org website. The piece is titled, Liz Cheney Reveals Ivanka Visited Donald Trump at least twice on 6th of January to stop the violence. Former President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka visited at least twice on 6th of January 2021 in an effort to stop the attack on the U.S. Capitol, according to Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming. During an interview on ABC, Liz Cheney explained why the 6th of January Select Committee could consider criminal charges for former President Donald Trump. Liz Cheney said, "We're learning much more about what former President Trump was doing while the violent assault was underway," Cheney told ABC host George Stephanopoulos. She added, "The committee has first-hand testimony now that he was sitting in the dining room next to the Oval Office in the White House watching the attack on television as the assault on the Capitol occurred. The briefing room at the White House is just a mere few steps from the Oval Office," she continued. "The president could have at any moment walked those very few steps into the briefing room, gone on live television and told his supporters who were assaulting the Capitol to stop the attack. He could have told them to stand down. He could have told them to go home, and he failed to do so." Liz Cheney said that there was no question that Donald Trump's failure to act was a dereliction of duty. She added, "But I think it's also important for the American people to understand how dangerous Donald Trump was," she asserted. "We know, as he was sitting there in the dining room next to the Oval Office at the White House, members of his staff were pleading with him to go on television, to tell people to stop. We know that leader Kevin McCarthy was pleading with him to do just that. We know members of his own family," she added. "We know his daughter Ivanka. We have first-hand testimony that his daughter Ivanka went in at least twice to ask him to please stop the violence. Any man who would not do so, any man who would provoke a violent assault on the Capitol to stop the counting of electoral votes, any man who would watch television as police officers were being beaten, as his supporters were invading the Capitol of the United States, is clearly unfit for future office, and clearly can never be anywhere near the Oval Office ever again." Meanwhile, the former President Donald Trump awaits a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court on whether his presidential records relating to the Capitol attack should remain confidential or free for the 6th of January Select Committee to review. The twice-impeached former President Donald Trump is continuing to put out disinformation about the attack. On Wednesday, 29th of December, after news broke that the Select Committee was narrowing a portion of its records request, a decision that was mutually reached with the Biden White House, Donald Trump issued a public statement replete with lies and distortions. Trump's statement read, "The Unselect Committee of radical left Democrats and two-thirds Republicans has just dropped a large proportion of their requests for my records and documents. A very big story, even though the New York Times refused to put it on the front page." Donald Trump said in a 29th of December statement, he added, "The reason that they dropped the records request is that they don't want this horror show to happen to Biden and Hunter in 3 years' time. This also changes the entire complexion of their request. Not that there are any documents that would be incriminating or a problem for me. But the witch hunt continues. Meanwhile, the 6th of January House Select Committee has interviewed over 300 people and pored over thousands of documents relating to the 6th of January 2021 assault on the Capitol.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grimman-Perez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror,
it's nonsense.
It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroys the Middle East. Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic, because it is a lot to digest.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide for those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited. And it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today without watching this film is like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
film... Of course, that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well. Because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I walk away with, what was the impact? The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching...
And why
was that? Yeah.
Because all of it was so... kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today, and it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come onto the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
Mm. I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multi-million dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary. But we'll just have to move swiftly on just for now.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned a study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this million-dollar contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. And I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
Really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Maria, what was your reaction to the connections being made between the U.S. military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world, as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it, because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity. And it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer that lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling. And you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Yeah, maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy, because he does everything via Twitter, and we have the biggest arms deal, and put that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not, because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history. And I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached, at the start of the transatlantic slave trade. Because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization. But this was the first time it was actually industrialized. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move swiftly on, and we'll pick up your next point in the next part of the discussion.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq. I'd been 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, dozens of other places I've been, and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously, is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down, and they try to gag them. Mm-hmm. And that's appalling, and it shouldn't happen, but it does, and it's still happening today.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep the sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that?
Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything, they're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... the African National Congress. Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in new Labour and was, the spiritual light here, who's going to bring all this hope, and yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you had Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud... having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him. And he said, no, you need to stop this. Otherwise... we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less? That's disgusting, really. And he got away with it. But then he was, Teflon Tony, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, which is, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
The documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. The thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and they, if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Well, this takes us to a really good, great point. We're just going to move on again.
Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.3